from Podcast One.
Coming up in this episode of Target USA.
One of the U.S.'s allies has a very interesting perspective on the situation with Russia. It's Croatia.
Russia was, in a sense, the Soviet Union disintegrated. But what was amazing, and it's somewhat neglected as a fact, is that it disintegrated mostly peacefully. One would have not expected something like that to happen. So there was a moment in history when we thought that there would be a possibility of having a partnership, almost an alliance eventually with Russia, convergence on the Russia being a democratic country.
Pierre Simonovic is the ambassador from Croatia to the U.S., and he warns from experience that Russia is looking for every opportunity to step into power voids.
And we have seen that. I was previously ambassador. I was exactly ambassador in Israel during the times when Russia became very active in the Middle East.
And he warns, now is not the time to whistle past the graveyard of the Cold War.
Coming up on this edition of Target USA.
The National Security Podcast.
From WTOP in Washington, D.C., this is Target USA. Russia
could render huge harm to this country.
North Korea's secret missile.
Capable of reaching the whole of the United States.
Dangerous terrorist.
D.C. is repeatedly mentioned as someplace they would like to seek an attack.
Cyber criminals.
Decryption successful.
America has a target on its back. And on this program, we investigate the threats, the people behind them, the agencies fighting them, and the impact on you. This is Target USA,
the National Security Podcast.
I'm J.J. Green.
Croatia took over the presidency of the European Union just recently. Croatia has its work cut out for it because the European Union is facing a lot of challenges, not the least of which is the uncertainty looming because of the now complete Brexit. But also, there's the big question of what Russia is doing in that region. Pierre Simonovic, Croatia's ambassador to the U.S., joins Target USA to discuss those challenges that lay ahead. Ambassador Simonovic, it is always a pleasure to talk with a fellow journalist, but it's rare that I get a chance to talk to a fellow journalist on this program. We're focused on discussions with experts in national security, so we don't have the opportunity to talk to journalists, but it's always a pleasure to meet one who has served in a journalistic capacity. And you were a journalist at the BBC, no less, right?
Correct, yes.
Tell us about that.
No, in the first place, thank you for having me. And it's my really great pleasure and very beautiful experience being back to the radio. And I still consider myself very much a journalist. I was professionally formed as a journalist, working for the main Croatian daily at the time and then going to the BBC. So working both in the print media and at the radio, and there is a special flair about the radio, as you know. There is a special buzz about journalism, and I guess I never stopped being a journalist. Mm-hmm. Despite the other things I've been doing. My area of expertise, while I was a journalist, I was covering mostly the collapse of communism in the Central and Eastern Europe, very much Russia, and finally the collapse and the war, the wars in the former Yugoslavia.
I recall that era, certainly the collapse of Yugoslavia and the Balkan Wars. I recall that era. Tell me what your experience was growing up, and of course, being a young journalist at the time. What do you remember most about that time frame?
You know, where is the in terms of Yugoslavia as such? It was it was a communist country. There was no doubt about it. It was not a part of the Soviet bloc as such. But in terms of the freedoms and liberties, we now and you all the time have been taking for granted, did not exist at the time. So we were struggling to convey the truth at the time. But in the starting from the late 80s, the things politically started to unravel in Croatia, in former Yugoslavia as well, and all over the Central and Eastern Europe, including Russia. And I was really extremely fortunate, if you wish, professionally, that I was able to be present and to cover them all, starting with the historical roundtable talks in Poland in 1989, then the first free elections in Poland, a lot of things began in Poland, actually, demonstrating that the first breach within communism was possible, and exposing the system as being brittle, and then the whole thing starting to unravel. And the role of Mikhail Gorbachev and the whole thing, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the whole thing was unraveling extremely fast. That's what I was able to see specifically in Romania, that the one regime which was extremely one of the most autarkic, most dictatorial, Ceausescu regime, to crumble in a matter of days, if not weeks.
Mm-hmm. You know, this being 2020, a long time since that all took place, but there are some very troubling signs arising from Eastern Europe these days, and no less the Balkans are included in this because of Russia. Because of the communist platform program, because of the communist ideology, because of many things that people thought were done and finished many years ago with the fall of the Berlin Wall. But you've once again, you know, found yourself, you, your countrymen, in a place that is a very difficult place right now. Would you explain or give us a sense of how that feels?
That is very interesting indeed. I mean, during the 90s, as you all know, during the Yeltsin times, Russia was, in a sense, the Soviet Union disintegrated. But what was amazing, and it's somewhat neglected as a fact, is that it disintegrated mostly peacefully. One would have not expected something like that to happen. So there was a moment in history when we thought that there would be a possibility of having a partnership, almost an alliance eventually with Russia, convergence on the Russia being a democratic country, being part of the same kind of strategic and civilizational, culturally it is a European, it is a Western country up to a large extent, thanks to its European anchorage, if you wish. But this is not to be. And during that particular time, Russia was very much absent in terms of trying to project influences in its immediate neighborhood. It was basically letting the newly independent countries go. Not enthusiastically, and certainly not when it comes to their membership in NATO specifically and the European Union, but it was not very, it was opposing vocally, but it was not, there was nothing much Russia was able to do. And on the other side, NATO and us all, and including the U.S., indeed leading with the U.S., was basically handing a hand to Russia, helping Russia getting rid of the stabilizing nuclear arsenal, getting rid of the WMD. So there was a sense of partnership, but then suddenly all that changed. Basically, it coincides with the Putin's leadership, and Russia has become gradually more assertive, up to the extent that it became aggressive, with the moves against Georgia, with the moves against Ukraine, brinkmanships, creating certain mischief on the margin, which is not marginal for the Baltic countries certainly. And we, for example, had to also be participate in the forward deterrence posture NATO has vis-a-vis Russia in Lithuania and in Poland. One of our units on the multiple rocket launchers in Poland is under the U.S. command. So the shift from a possibility that there may be a genuine partnership with Russia to having what we have now, this is not the repetition of the Cold War, because Russia is clearly not the Soviet Union in terms of its global reach, in terms of its economic and military potentials. But it is not what it was, well, so what it could have been, maybe.
You said what we have now. What is it that we have now? How do you characterize what we have now with Russia and then the rest of the world, especially Eastern Europe, Croatia?
I would say in some aspects, certainly there is a cooperation with Russia when it comes for us all, I guess. When it comes to some specific issues such as combating terrorism, combating some aspects of organized crime, some aspects of trade, that could have been that needs to be better. But it's up to Russia's behavior to create a framework within which that can happen. And based upon the aggressive moves Russia had made, based upon the interference Russia is doing into the different spheres of life of some around the world, For example, what Russia was trying to do in the Southeast Europe, it tended to be rather absent when it comes when it was coming to former Yugoslavia. It was a bit outside the Soviet zone of influence. It was a communist country, but it was not part of the Soviet bloc. So it was staying outside the Moscow's influence. So, but with today's Russia, they are very much interested in trying to influence the countries of not moving towards the EU, not moving towards NATO. They try to get into the substantial amount chunks of the given country's industry in order to be able to exercise the influence through the economic means. They are trying to keep the countries within its energy grip. So yeah. There are a lot of unconventional, the hybrid, if you wish, ways in which they are trying to influence decision making of many countries.
So let's bring this to the U.S. The U.S. election in 2016, there was a significant amount of very obvious interference from Russia outside of the sphere of influence. But certainly you mentioned aggressive activities and aggressive behaviors and interferences that Russia had engaged in. You also mentioned the era of Putin. So put in context for us why this is happening, why under Putin, and what Putin's objectives are.
I guess it certainly does not come out of the blue. There has been always in Russia's political thinking that Russia is a great country. And that is this country very much exposed to different aggressions from all sides, having a large soft underbelly. So many things Russia is doing get justified by the Russian leadership as a defensive move. You know, But ultimately, what boils down is that they consider a wider region around Russia, which is a region consisting of sovereign countries, as something they call it near neighborhood, meaning that they consider this is a kind of perpetuation of a notion of limited sovereignty of some countries which should be totally sovereign.
Forgive me for interrupting, Ambassador, but defensive measures. Their Central African Republic, you know, is hardly a threat to Russia, but you have Yevgeny Prigozhin. And you have many people that are part of his organization. You have the troll factory in St. Petersburg that he runs, but you also have election interference activities taking place in Madagascar. You have all sorts of Morocco. So that's not defensive, is it?
No, it's certainly not. What they said. I mean, I want to be clear on that. This is not what it is, but this is how they are trying to justify vis-a-vis themselves and vis-a-vis the international community. Everything they do is meant to keep Russia safe.
So, do they think the international community is not smart enough to know, as you know, and everybody else knows that no, this is not a defensive move. This is just pure.
Well, certainly they're certainly not admitting that they the interference you have been describing and the interferences which are happening, and certainly they're not describing what they did vis-a-vis Ukraine and Russia Ukraine and Georgia, sorry, as an aggression. They consider that keeping the Russian minority safe, keeping they describe it differently, but certainly according to international law and according to common sense, this is not the case.
So what is Croatia and its neighbors and the U.S. And the U.K. and I guess the rest of the people that Russia considers maybe adversaries or certainly not friends, what are all these nations to do about this aggressive behavior and certainly untoward behavior there's really no better way to put it than just disrespectful behavior. So what are all these nations to do about this?
In the first place, I guess the point of departure is our genuine wish to have a good relationship with Russia, mm-hmm. to have a constructive, mutually benefiting relationship in all fields of all walks of life. But this is not only what I'm saying on behalf of Croatia. It is applicable to any country within the transatlantic context. That is what we would like to have. have. But the ball is very much in Russia's court in that regard. So we have to respond accordingly. And what we have been seeing, exactly as you have been describing, this is not conducive to such an outcome. So we have to stand firm. We have to deter. We have to react. And the stronger we are, the less an option of any kind of escalation becomes possible or plausible. I mentioned NATO's forward deterrence posture, which is very important in sending a message that we stand each and every one of us stand for each other. In terms of defending us, that is the famous Article 5
of NATO, yes.
Absolutely. The U.S. is an extremely important, fundamental, important partner, ally for us all. And what we are getting from our U.S. friends is certainly a strong commitment to that Article 5. And this is functioning beautifully. What we have put together and what we will be putting together certainly serves a cause of peace and stability in Europe. Mm-hmm. Also, there is a necessity to act jointly when it comes to the all kinds of interferences. We have been feeling ourselves and other countries in the region. It is not maybe a part of a master plan, but once there is a kind of weakness and yet there is an opportunity, then you see that some country is coming to fill the void. Mm-hmm. And we have seen that. I was previously ambassador. I was exactly ambassador in Israel during the times when Russia became very active in the Middle East. Before, it was almost absent. There was nothing much happening. But the fact that suddenly an opening has been created in Syria enabled Russia to become truly a major player in the Middle East, which has not been to such an extent, at least not in a not Soviet Union was a major player all over the place, indeed, because of its size, because of strength, and because the appeal and the vehicle of its ideology, which is the communist ideology. Now there is no ideology. There is no ideology whatsoever. Now they are pure interests, and they have been able to play their cards, their limited cards, I would say. Because we're talking about a country which doesn't have an impressive GDP. Mm-hmm. It's not a peer competitor to the U.S. in the first place.
Can the West trust Vladimir Putin?
We have to understand what makes his moves, and what was his rationale, what his ideology. We have recently seen that he made his move internally, reinforcing a state council.
Getting ready to do
something which we cannot see where it leads, but the overall analysis of everybody watching it is that he intends to be in power also when his
2024
comes. His second mandate expires and constitutionally he cannot remain president. So there is certainly an attempt to try to find a way of being remaining in charge after that at that period.
But Ambassador,
in some aspects, I would say that maybe I or Croatia is not in the best of positions to make that assessment. Those who have been dealing with the president of Russia have been U.S. presidents, several of them, and they've been in a much better position to respond to the question of trust or not.
That is.
In some aspects, I would say yes. When it comes to counterterrorism, certainly there is a level of cooperation we have with Russia, which we need to have.
Sure. So yes,
part of the international system.
Yes,
important part.
Yes, Putin can be trusted on some things.
Like any leader, I guess. Like any legitimate leader of any given country.
Okay. So, and the reason I ask this question is because, given what has happened, and you mentioned this, the recent changing of, or at least the interest, his move to change the Constitution, and his prime minister, which of course he does have the right as president to do, to ask for a new government. The whole government essentially decides, okay, it's time to go. And then, you know, there's the new person who supposedly is, some people call him a yes man or whatever. there's this question about why is he doing this. This is the reason why I asked the question about trust, because it suggests that he's turning over a new leaf to the untrained observer. But those like yourself who are steeped in this understanding and know this very well, some of them have suggested that he has his eye on a whole new country and has his eye on a neighboring country as well. Have you heard anything of this, and can you explain what this may be about?
There have been some speculations about the union with Belarus in particular.
Belarus.
But my understanding is that at least they have seen that this is not working as smoothly as envisaged.
So what would
and
that...
One of the responses was the move that has been made recently, creating this new constitutional reshaping.
So how would that work? What is the...
I don't know. I really don't know. We don't know, and I don't think that anybody knows. How would that work in practice? We can only detect an attempt to keep there is a French saying plus ça change plus ça reste la même chose. The more the thing I think changes, the more it remains the same thing. And that may be one of those things.
La même chose.
Him remaining in power one way or another.
Okay, so let's speculate a little bit without attaching any certainty to this, but just for the purpose of understanding this a bit, if Russia were to join with another country, that would be a bombshell, would it not?
It would be indeed, and clearly it would constitutionally it would create a new landscape politically.
And how would something like that work? Would it be like a country, like a business merging with something else? I mean, I guess so.
But it doesn't seem that this is such a likely option at this stage.
Really?
I would say.
So it seems like a.
I would say, and there is precisely because of that you had this thing of the constitutional reshaping.
Hmm.
Otherwise, it would have been something else.
Yeah. So. That is on the horizon. We'll have to wait and see another 4 years, maybe. Or
I guess so.
In between now and then, because his term does not end until 2024, and you have a lot of other business to attend to. But you, I'm sure, will keep one eye on that situation and all of the situations that Russia has its hand in, and all of your neighbors and all of your situations. But let me just get back more directly to Croatia. What are Croatia's biggest concerns and issues at this point?
I would say at this very specific moment, and it also coincides with us having assumed the rotating presidency of the European Council for the first 6 months of this year. So basically we have a special responsibility when it comes to the European Union as a whole in a very critical times of managing what we think it needs to be well-regulated, smooth Brexit, leaving no grievances, establishing really a very close relationship with the UK, which remains a fundamental ally with NATO. So this is a matter of great concern strategically. The second thing is it's more internal European, but it is important, as you can guess. Anything involving money is very important. We should also the new commission is in place, the new European government is Jewish. And we need to put together the so-called multi-annual financial framework, which is a multi-annual budget, and that has to be agreed. And it's always tricky and tense. We are discussing money, who will be paying how much, and for what. So this is what's going. What's going on. But for the in an immediate national security sense, on top of this deterioration of the entire European strategic landscape because of the behavior of Russia, to which we as NATO had to respond in order to make sure...
And you
sure,
call it deterioration.
I would call it deterioration, absolutely. If you compare the strategic landscape, geostrategic landscape in Europe of some 10 years ago, and now we see that something has changed. And what has changed is the possibility of a conventional war in Europe has somewhat increased. Before that, it was almost inconceivable in terms of the big war.
What kind of war?
We have seen what Russia did with Georgia. We have seen what Russia did with Ukraine. We had seen the continuous provocations, if you wish, happening up in the north vis-a-vis the three Baltic countries. So we see disturbing patterns of behavior. We don't think that the any kind of unconventional war or aggression is plausible, likely, or certain. This is not the case. But that in order to make that possibility unlikely as possible, we need to stand firm and we need to demonstrate determination. And that is what we are doing within NATO, in order to create an environment conducive to partnership with Russia, but at the same time making sure that the Russia is not contemplating making any intrusive, aggressive moves vis-a-vis its neighborhood, particularly its NATO neighborhood. So this is in the large picture, that together with suppressing international terrorism, which remains a matter of concern, as we see the international terrorism, generated by extreme Islam, remains a threat. It always morphs into something new. This issue has not been resolved. We see a great instability in the Middle East. And connected with the instability in the Middle East and in Central Asia, Afghanistan in the first place, what we feel on our borders is the pressure of illegal migration. Mm. And it's happening now through different routes. It's happening. Bosnia is getting more and more exposed to being getting filled with illegal migrants. And these illegal migrants are trying to get into the West, and the West is not admitting them, so they're pushing on Croatian borders.
Where are they coming from?
They're coming from Middle East, be it Iraq, be it Syria, Pakistan, Afghanistan,
How are they getting to Eastern Europe?
This is also a thing of law and order, I think, in international. They are moving themselves, but they are being shuttled back and forth by different criminal groups. Mm. Criminal groups along the route.
So this is a Europol problem too.
Europol, European Union problem, and a wider international problem. And then some of our European Union allies are exposed to the Northern African across the Mediterranean. So this is a major move of people. And if somebody is searching for an asylum, yeah, based upon the justifiable grounds, they're international as it's applicable to the U.S. or any other country, to take a look into that. But many, a vast majority of them is simply searching for a better life, which is, I guess, legitimate from their point of view. But we are a country of 4 million. We have accepted a couple of thousands of people and trying to integrate them in a smaller reasonable numbers. It functions nicely,
yeah,
but the excessive numbers would overwhelm the services, yeah, in the country. It doesn't make any sense.
It's a matter of resources. You cannot.
Absolutely, absolutely. And nobody else is. So we have become like Greece. It has already been very much exposed. Greece was mm-hmm. the closest. And then all along the route towards, yeah, the West, we have now problems, and we feel the pressure mounting, and we certainly think, and we certainly advocate, that this is not an issue a single country can deal with, or a single country can be left to deal with.
Yeah.
We have to have a joint response to that, and the joint policies and joint resources.
So, the problem of immigration, illegal immigration, is still an issue, and we need to remain vigilant and focus on that journalistically as well, and we will. Something I'd like to jump back to before we get too far afield from it. You talked about the deterioration of the strategic landscape in Europe, and you also mentioned the possibility, remote possibility, of a war, a big war. So who in that unlikely scenario would be involved in this war?
What we have seen, given Russia's posture on its western borders, is certainly the unfriendly, I would say, deployment in close to that western border. with the Baltic countries, when it comes to the enclave of Kaliningrad, when it comes to the when it comes to what's happening in Belarus. And it all depends upon our posture. If our posture is strong and robust enough, nothing will be happening, because it will be having a deterrent effect. So that is the key. Mm-hmm. If we are robust and determined and judicious enough, any kind of possibility of conventional aggression, conventional war is less and less likely. And in that regard, I would say the American contribution, the American leadership is an indispensable ingredient not for the sake of Europeans, but I would say also for the security of this great country.
So, at this point, this is just something, a possibility, a remote possibility. Is that correct?
That is on a ladder of intelligence ladder, as you know, you yourself being a national security expert, everything starts with the possibility. There are things which are not possible, and certainly there has been always a possibility, because you have the resources, you have the points of friction. And then up the ladder, you have plausibility, likeliness, something being very likely, something being almost certain. In order to make it highly unlikely, we have to stand firm. Mm-hmm. That is actually how we can contribute to shape things. Mm-hmm. Instead of reacting on something, it is just happening. But on the other side, we have seen a proven willingness and ability to act aggressively. I'm repeating the case of Georgia. I'm repeating the case of Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Well. That is, we've talked a lot about some dark things and some troubling things, but that is just the reality of the world we live in today. And I don't want to spend the entire interview talking about those dark things, because there are many positive things that are going on. And I'd like to ask you at this point, we've talked about some of the threats and problems that Croatia faces, but I'd like to as well talk about some of the optimism, some of the positive, some of the elements and developments in and around Croatia that are good.
Yeah, I mean, thank you for asking. I mean, it's really, when one gets into these darker aspects of life, then one may leave an impression that this is the only thing we have. This is certainly not the case.
Yeah.
For example, when you look at our short history of our modern statehood, established after the collapse of former Yugoslavia and the collapse of communism, and despite the fact that we as a distinct nation, having a distinct culture and distinct ethnicity, have survived for centuries, despite not having our own state, independent state, sovereign state. We have, in a sense, transferred sovereignty to larger entities, but we have been able to survive. So that is a fundamentally important victory. And then in the early 90s, we came out of what was even happening. We have been exposed to the aggression led by the Yugoslav army and by the Serbian leader at the time, Slobodan Milosevic, who was to die imprisoned in The Hague, mm-hmm. Accused of war crimes he committed, and he led the Yugoslav and the Serbian paramilitary to do in Croatia, in Bosnia, and Kosovo. From that, in a relatively short period of time, it was, let's say, a generation, 25 years ago or so, from not even being, before 91, not being recognized internationally as a country, being a communist country, and within that 25 years, having been able to get into NATO, get into the EU, and basically now being holding the rotating presidency of the EU, which is one of the biggest concentrations of wealth and an integration based upon the values of democracy, freedom, and liberty. That's an amazing feat, is it mm-hmm. not? I mean, when you think about it. And certainly the economy is doing better and better. We have a robust...
I was about to ask you about that.
3%, and forecast is good.
What is
tourism is booming. Tourism is booming. We are well known for us being a tourist country.
Sure.
We have the latest I have seen. We have almost 700,000 U.S. tourists a year.
Sure.
What is the country? That's beautiful.
What is your biggest export?
Our biggest industry is tourism.
Okay.
Our biggest industry is tourism. And we are getting more and more.
I always thought that Croatia was a very lush place where you could grow things.
Yeah, that is also the case. We have strong potential for agriculture. We are a gastronomically beautiful country for enjoying oneself. Wine, we produce beautiful wine. So these are all the tourism and the associated supporting industries are the most important source of revenue.
Mm-hmm.
Manufacturing, the growth is also based upon strong foreign investments.
Well, I've been very selfish today in asking all the questions that I had, but I want to ask, are there any areas you'd like to discuss that we haven't talked about?
Well, what I was doing throughout my professional career as a diplomat, then later on in the defense ministry, then in the national security field, has been, and also as a journalist, has been leading me to a very, very close cooperation with the U.S. So formatively for many of us in the post-communist, communism is long gone, Central and Eastern Europe, the role played by the U.S. has been so fundamentally important in the keeping the light of freedom and liberty alive. Maybe this is an opportunity to thank you and to take all the Americans for being with us all the time, for never letting the communism prevail.
Hmm. Well, you know,
I remember my final observation during communist times in the center of Zagreb. There was the U.S. Information center, mm-hmm, with the U.S. newspapers, New York Times, Washington Post, different media, which were not ready. There was no internet at the time.
Yeah.
There were books, publications. So it was really like a window into freedom.
Mm-hmm.
So for us all, the U.S. played a especially important, fundamentally important role in bringing down communism. And soon after that, it became immediately the most important partner, mm-hmm, when it comes to national security across the full spectrum of what national security means. So yeah. that is the case with us as well. We have been our particular partner is Minnesota National Guard, as we have a state partnership program with the Minnesota. So we at the time, more than 10 years ago, while I was in defense ministry, we were basically forming joint units with our friends from the Minnesota National Guard, fused units.
Mm-hmm.
So there was an immense trust in each other.
Our company is owned by a company based in Minnesota. So
imagine that, fantastic. So Minnesota is close to our heart.
Yeah, Ambassador, thank you so much.
JJ, thank you so much. It has been my great pleasure to be here.
That's Ambassador Pierre Simunovic, the representative of Croatia in the United States. Coming up in our next episode, what are the key national security threats the U.S. faces?
You have your big four, China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, all the challenges that they present, and some of the newer things that have really risen in the last few years, things like counterintelligence.
Deirdre Walsh is the Chief Operating Officer in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. We know there are lots of secret things going on that they can't talk about, but the fact that they're secret and are so important is what drives her.
There are things that the IC has been in the forefront of that are truly eye-watering, and being able to be part of that community is honestly what gets me out of bed in the morning.
And those mornings start early, and they turn into days that last very long. And it doesn't stop there.
A phone call in the middle of the night is never welcome.
But living in the times we live in, they may be happening more frequently. The U.S. intelligence community. What are the challenges? What are the threats? How are they approaching them? Deirdre Walsh talks about it on her next episode of Target USA. If you have any questions or comments about our program, send me an email at jgreen@wtop.com. That's the letter J, the color green, one word, at whiskeytangooscarpapa.com. That's jgreen@wtop.com. Also, Follow us on Twitter at TUSA Podcast. That's at Tango Uniform Sierra Alpha Podcast. And subscribe to our podcast, please. And if you want more information about what's going on around the world and, of course, in the national security space, sign up for my newsletter. It's called Inside the SCIF, and you can sign up at WTOP.com/alerts.
I'm J.J. Green, and this is Target USA,
the National Security Podcast.
If you love true crime podcast, Podcast One is the perfect destination. We've got two awesome true crime podcasts trending right now, and you have to check them out. First, based on the iconic series on A&E, Cold Case Files explores some of the most difficult to solve murders which stymied investigators and then went cold, sometimes for decades. Next up, Autopsy. It's the latest podcast from Reels and Podcast One. Every episode takes you in depth with celebrity deaths and their true causes. Check out both Cold Case Files and Autopsy. They're going to be your next favorite true crime podcast. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcast, Podcast One, and many of your favorite podcast listening apps. Now, stay tuned for the latest headlines from the Associated Press.